is obviously very close. And the truth is that Purim, there are many very interesting things to think about in terms of Purim. And I'd like to cover some of the topics. Obviously, it's very extensive. But I would like to cover, you know, certainly a couple of the ideas, sort of the main themes of Purim. First of all, you have to realize something that, and as we will see, it's responsible for one of the dinim. Purim is a very highly, very unlikely story to have ever happened. You know, it sounds, you know, straightforward. Well, we know there's a hero, it's Mordecai, there's Esther. We all know the story, right? And the heroine, of course, is Esther. Then the villains are Haman, Ahasuerus. You know, it's really a tremendous story of intrigue when you really think about that. It's a highly unusual story. But the truth is, if you really think about that, Purim should really never have happened. Not because of the Jews, the sin that the Jews had done. But the truth is, the story is filled with unlikely circumstances. And that's how we begin to see what's called the spiritual divine underpinnings of the whole story. Let me show you the things that really should never have happened. First idea is that the story starts off with obviously with a huge Suda feast. Ahasuerus, of course, is celebrating, or whatever he's celebrating, as I'll say, because the Beis HaMikdash was not built, and so on, you know. But obviously they got really very lively and drunk. And Ahasuerus makes a request, which in many ways is almost unheard of. He requests that Vashti appears, and that's really the beginning of the story. That shows you certain very interesting things. But he makes a request that he asks Vashti to appear, let's just say, in a very inappropriate manner. Okay, and we know what he wanted. And the question is he crazy? Nobody does that. I mean, we're talking about Vashti, who's the queen. For him to make a request like that is unheard of. Nobody would do that to their wife, let alone to the queen. Because if he does that to the queen, that's the end of any type of respect or authority. Could you imagine the King of England, I don't think there is no King of England, but you know, Philip, whatever, and says to Queen Elizabeth, well, you gotta come out, you know how? Could you believe this? Nobody would believe this. This is completely barbaric and uncivilized. And the truth is, even barbaric, this is not even barbaric. People don't do that because minimally it destroys the authority of the queen. Yet that's what he did. You see, and I don't care if he was drunk. It doesn't make a difference. Nobody gets that drunk. And if they got that drunk, they would pass out. They would never do that. Think about that. We don't realize, but this kind of thing never happens. That's the first thing. Second thing that never happens, you know, is that Ahasuerus was not of royal blood. We know that. He was a general in the army. And somehow he rose to power. The one who was of royal blood was really Vashti. She was the real queen. She was a granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar, whatever, see? So therefore, his whole claim to fame was really through Vashti. That's his whole claim. He was a nobody. Now, nobody was a general, that was it, you know? Certainly to be the king of Persia. I mean, Persia was the greatest empire in the world after Babylon. And what does he do? He kills Vashti. Imagine that she is the only legitimate claim to the throne that he has. And he went and killed her. And also doesn't make a difference. And when he killed her, he was sober. So you can't use the excuse that he was drunk, right? Why would he do that? I mean, okay, he was angry enough for his insane request. Fine, okay. But you can't kill the woman without her. You're nobody. Yet he killed her. That's the second thing that doesn't make any sense. You see? Third thing that doesn't make sense. I'm just trying to show you how impossible the story really is. The third thing that doesn't make sense is that, okay, he wants to get married. He's a king, he needs a queen, right? So what do kings do when they want to get married, right? They don't marry commoners, except King George, what was the guy's name, in 1935, when he married, what's her name, whatever her name was. You know, she was a divorcee.
Yeah, Wallace.
Who? Wallace, yeah, yeah, whatever. Yeah. But kings don't marry commoners. They don't marry commoners. So, because kings, what they usually do is they marry somebody who is a princess of some other kingdom. So what they can do is unify kingdoms. You know, it's a trade deal, basically, in many ways, you know. But who does he do? So what does he do? He wants to marry a commoner, which itself doesn't make sense. That's not the way things are done. That's the third thing. Then we have a fourth thing, is what? How does he decide to marry the queen, the commoner? So how do normal Jews do? They go to a shadchan, you know? This guy comes up, and this probably was the original, you know? He decides to have a beauty contest, you know? I mean, this is good for America. This doesn't go on in kingdoms like Persia or whatever. They don't do it this way. So you're gonna throw a beauty contest? That's the fourth incredible idea. And then, of course, who wins? Esther. Now, why was that unusual? Because Esther was like 70 years old, according to Chazal. And she said she had a green complexion, you know? I mean, he must have loved the color green. Why else would he marry her? Why would anybody marry a 70-year-old woman? I don't care how great she is, chesed, and she's an incredible smile. You know, it's like marrying your grandmother. Why would a person do that? So that's also impossible, you see. That also really could never have happened. And that's number five. Then all of a sudden, luck would have it, right? What's the luck? Mordechai happened to overhear Bigson Viserys planning to kill the king. Can you imagine being in the exact place at that point? And of course, they didn't speak Persian. They spoke some other language, right? And yet, because he was a member of the Sanhedrin, right, he knew the language, correct? So he just happened to be at the right time, at the right place, right, by a plot being uncovered to kill the king. What an incredible mazel. What's the odds about that? And I don't. What's so strange about that is usually when people plot to kill a king, right, they don't speak loud. It was obviously loud enough to hear that Mordechai could hear this, you know? And even if they felt nobody would understand the language, you still don't do that. You're talking about killing the king, that's the greatest act of treason, right? For which, of course, is immediate death, you know? So how in the world did he hear this? That's number six, you see. And then what's number seven? Imagine, right? You go over to a king and you save his life, right? You think the guy would ask you, well, what can I do for you? Right? I want to pay you back for saving my life. He didn't do anything for Mordechai. I mean, what kind of ungrateful wretch is this guy? Guy saves his life, right? And the king does nothing. We know that because it's only later on that somebody tells him, by the way, you never rewarded Mordechai, right? Which means he never rewarded the guy. I mean, what did he do? He forgot about what Mordechai did, and he knew it was Mordechai because she told him in the name of the name of Mordechai, right? B'shem Mordechai, right? So he knew it was Mordechai. So why wouldn't the king reward this guy, Mordechai? You see, this also doesn't make any sense. That's number seven. Fine. Then, of course, Haman grows in stature. That can happen. Obviously, he's a very bright guy. You don't appoint a guy Grand Vizier who's a dope, right? So he's a bright guy. You're talking about the second most powerful man in the Persian Empire, which, by the way, is basically the whole empire of the earth. It's 127 Medinas, you see. So what happens? All of a sudden, one night, right, and then there's a whole intrigue, you know, and Esther wants to have a party and so on and so forth, because she's going to confront the Haman. In any case, all of a sudden, comes a night, and the king can't sleep, right? Now, usually, if the king can't sleep, what do you do? Give him some tea, some warm milk, or whatever, right? So he wakes up. Right? Now, if somebody can't go to sleep, what do they do? Like I said, you know, they'll take tea. I know what the guy's got in his castle and so on, palace, whatever, and so on. So what does he request to be read? Imagine he wants to read the text, chronology of Persia. Right? This is the fascinating thing that he's got to read in the middle of the night. Why would anybody read that? You don't even read that in the day, let alone at night. Right? I wonder if something like that. You know, he wants the prestigious tomes, you know, that record all the transaction of Europe, of Persia, in the middle of the night or whatever. That stuff is bizarre. And that's miracle number 8. And of course, they open up the book, right? And bam, oh, as they say, lo and behold, it's right in front of them. You see? Mordechai saved the life of the king. You see? You know how many tomes, how many volumes Persian chronological history has? You think it was the only one? Could you imagine they took the exact one out, right? Right. Because any kingdom, any Persia, they had many, many volumes of the history of Persia, you see. So they pulled the exact one out, open up the book, and it falls to the exact page. What are the odds? There are no odds for this. No bookie would ever give you any odds for this type of behavior. You see? This is 9. It's a miracle, right? Okay, so all of a sudden, you know, they are knocking the door. Well, who's there? It's Haman. Why is Haman visiting the king at 3 a.m.? This is my question. Who goes to visit a king at 3 a.m. when the guy's obviously sleeping? You see? Which also doesn't make sense. What's he doing there? Okay, you're excited because, you know, Esther invited you. That's great. But you don't visit the king in the middle of the night. And then what does the king do? Right? Because he had asked previously, what do we do for Mordechai? Nothing. Nothing. So he asks Haman, what do you think we should do? Now, Haman, of course, was a classic megalomaniac. He says to himself, well, I'll tell you what to do. You take the king's horse, the crown. This is what he's saying. The horse, the robe, the garments, and the crown. And the whole, right? And you let the, whoever this guy is, because he figures it's me, right? And you let him ride through the streets, and you say, Kochi Yosalish, thus should be done to a man whom the king will honor, right? Now, this is sick. Why? And you have to think about that. If you're talking about kings of the old days, there was only one thing they were worried about besides tax money, right? And that is somebody's going to kill them. They always worry about that. That's why when Roman emperors became, guess what? They killed out the entire family. This was known. Why? Especially the rivals, the brothers, right? You killed out all your brothers. Because the last thing you want is them taking over your kingdom. This went on all the time in ancient countries, see? Now, who would Ahasuerus think would want to take over his kingdom? Because remember, he's not royal, remember, right? Any guy can sit on his throne, you see? Obviously, the first one he would think would be guilty would be who? Haman. Why would Haman give him a suggestion, right, that would clearly indicate, I'm interested in your throne? Think about that for a minute. It boggles the mind. And when I talk about a stupid person, Haman was a very bright guy. Yet he's giving him a suggestion that would incredibly arouse the suspicions of a king of Persia who anyway suspects everybody from trying to take over a throne, since anyway he's not royal. Yet that's what Haman does. You know, it defies logic how a person could possibly do that. I think that's miracle number 10, you know, if you're counting and so on. But just take a look at all this, see? And of course, he does that. Now, the next miracle, you know, you want to honor a guy, fine, no problem. But you don't honor a guy and then debase your grand vizier. You see, you have to remember what was going on. He was honoring Mordechai with this impossible nonsense of a crown. No king would ever do that. Give his crown away, his horse, and his garments. You don't do that. Okay, you want to be Meshigga? Fine. Right? Want to be crazy? Okay. So what you do is you honor Mordechai, but you don't debase your grand vizier. That's what he did. By having Haman carry, right, lead Mordechai, it wasn't just an elevation of Mordechai. It was an incredible degradation to the grand vizier. You see, we're not into that, you see, because we're not kings, we're not politicians or whatever. But think about it. You don't do that. You see, he could have picked out any minister. I mean, a lot of Choshev ministers there, right? Go back to any one of them. Why does he pick out the grand vizier? This is the interesting thing. Then, of course, he finally gets to meet with Esther and so on and so forth. And then Esther accused them. And lo and behold, the next thing we find Haman is on the bed on top of Esther. This was after the accusation of Esther, right? That he's the one who wants to kill me and my people and all that, right? I mean, this is the worst place to be on at that moment, right? When the king walked out enraged, right? And lo and behold, he's on top of Esther. Obviously, he was probably drunk, whatever guy, and he was begging for his life, but this is the wrong place to be. And of course, he came in and he said, you know, excuse me, you want to take my wife with me in my house also? You know what I'm saying? It's like you know, that's a death sentence. And then of course, his face fell. That's incredible. Can we say that a stroke of good luck? Right? And then all of a sudden, what was the coup d'etat? The final, right? It's Harona. Harona says, by the way, he just set up a whole thing for Mordechai. Talking about a guy who wants to kill everybody, right? You know, he just set up the guy. And that was, you know, sometimes you need a final statement, you know, to what's called clinch the deal, you know? He clinched the death sentence just with that statement. I mean, this stuff is incredible. You know, it really could never have happened. You know, one miracle, two miracles, but not 15. Because that's how many I just said, you know, incredible. Because what do we see from this? And that's what's very important. We don't realize how highly improbable the whole story is, you see. So then why did it happen? And the answer is because it's the Ribbono Shel Olam that makes everything happen. That's why. And to Ribbono Shel Olam, it doesn't make a difference if it's one miracle or 15 miracles. It's irrelevant. This whole thing was a setup. The Jews were chayav misa, whatever they ate at the meal. And at the very meal that they were done to be chayav misa, at that very meal, okay, they were saved. That was the beginning with the whole story with Vashti, you see. It's astounding when you think about this. And by the way, that's the origin of the costumes. Why do we wear costumes on Purim, you see? And the answer is because the whole story is nothing more than a costume. The whole teva is a masquerade or costume of God. It's not really... We're looking at a story, but that story is the Ribbono Shel Olam orchestrating everything. And that's really why you wear a costume. Because what you're really saying is, you see me, I have a certain appearance. That's not really who I am. I'm behind the mask, right? So therefore, that's what Purim really is. And Purim is a mask of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And we learn here that it doesn't make a difference how many miracles. It's the Ribbono Shel Olam that controls every step of what happened on Purim, just like he does everything, you see. And that's why the name of the holiday really is Purim. Purim means lots. Why would you name a holiday after what Haman threw lots to decide when to come Mordechai? Why would you name a holiday after that? And the answer is because the whole Purim looks like chance. A lot is chance. When you put your hand to a lottery and you come out with something, it's all about chance. So really, it's almost like a euphemism. Chance, you call this chance, you see? And that's Purim. Purim heightens the concept that this is impossible to be chance, you see? And that's why we have that, and so on. And there are many other things we learn about the whole concept and so on, you know? Which I can go into. In any case, there's a gematria. We have. Let's put it this way: Ad lo yoda is another custom. It's all related in many ways. Ad lo yoda, right? Between what? Baruch Mordechai, or I should say, right? Baruch Mordechai and Oral Homan. We don't know the difference, right? Why? And what you do is you get drunk. Some people say you can do it sleeping, whatever, right? One of the mitzvahs that we're supposed to do is to become in a semi-conscious state. I hate to use the word unconscious state. But in a state where you cannot distinguish between blessed Mordechai and cursed is Haman. Why would that be? Have you thought about that? It's an unusual type of mitzvah. Because what we learn from Paul is a very important idea. The Ribbono Shel Olam will not be frustrated, which means that God is in charge of everything, period. If you are a tzaddik and you're doing the will of God, great. Then you get rewarded. if you are in Russia, yes, and you don't want to do the will of God, you must do the will of God. That's what it is. Nobody can veer from the plan of God. The only thing you can have in that plan is, did you contribute to the plan or did you try to frustrate the plan? And that's, of course, if you contribute to the plan, you get reward. If you frustrate the plan, of course, then you're punished. But both must go in the direction of God. That is not possible to avert. It's very important. Haman had no choice. You see, we think Haman had Bechira, it's incredible that he made these foolish choices. But in the end, both, and I'm going to say it very interestingly, both are the agents of God. That's an incredible concept. A tzaddik is an agent of God, and a rosh is an agent of God. But like I said, the tzaddik gets reward for that agency, and the rosh gets punished. But neither can deny the ultimate plan of God. And therefore we see, Haman had no choice. You see, he thought he could destroy the Jews. On the contrary, it was he who did what? He's one of the responsible people who actually in many ways elevated Mordechai by leading him on the horse. He immediately put into the mind of everybody that Mordechai is a very great figure and so on. But the main idea is that Haman had no choice. And that's the reason why we have what? Adela Yoda. In fact, the gematria of Baruch Mordechai and the gematria of Orah Haman is the same gematria. Because what that tells us, and this is what we have to learn from Purim, all mankind are the agents of God. That's it. Whether you're tzaddik or rasha. But obviously there's a difference. If you contribute, like I said, you get tzchak. And if you deny and frustrate, then you get punished and so on. But we say Adel Yoda, right? To us there's a difference. Mordechai is the hero and Haman is the villain. To God, there's no difference. They're both shlichim. They're both agents. To God, it doesn't make a difference. Your choice. But you cannot deviate from my plan. That's what we learn from Adela Yoda. You see? That's why Chazal made that mitzvah. That we should not, in many ways, you cannot. To us, there's a difference between them. But to God, there is no difference. They will both ultimately fulfill the plan of God. And that's the mitzvah of Adela Yoda. Same concept. Many things that we learn from Purim, and I just explained, you know, basically two mitzvahs that happen with Purim, and so on. But in any case, think about that. Nisim, one after the other, of things that are never done, yet they all happen in an incredible sequence. It was a sequence of miracles. It took time, but these things really never happen, and so on. Something very important to think of, that no matter what happens to you, it must conform to the plan of God. Yeah, you have Bechira, you have free will, but even with free will, you must go in the plan of Tikkun to rectify the universe. Okay, that's one interesting thing. Next thing, one of the most difficult things to know in Torah is Haman. Is he out of his mind? Think about this. You see, again, you have to look at what's called, it's called the test of reasonableness, you see? You always should apply the test of reasonableness. Does this make, is this reasonable to understand? Makes sense in a reasonable way. Okay, let's ask ourselves about Haman. All right, there's a guy Mordechai. Yes, he doesn't want to bow in front of Haman. We know this from the Megillah, right? And all of a sudden, Haman fumes. Haman fumes, gets very angry, yes? So he says to one of his subordinates, who is this guy? Who's this? Yehudi, he's a Jew. So all of a sudden, Haman decides to wipe out Haman and every Jew, right? What did I say?
You said Haman, but you meant Mordechai.
I meant Mordechai, yeah. Okay.
Well, he wiped himself out anyway, so.
Yeah, okay. So Haman decides to destroy Mordechai and every Jew. The question is this, what do you want to kill the guy for? You're the second most powerful man in the kingdom. What, are you bothered by this guy? Yeah, put him in jail. Right? There's jail, right? What do you want to kill Mordechai for? You know, there's a lot you can do with Mordechai besides killing the guy. That's the first difficulty, okay? Second difficulty, okay? You want to kill Mordechai? Mordechai. What do you want to call the Jews for? What did they do to it? What? This is an incredibly racist idea. But I want to tell you something. you can't just say that Haman is an anti-Semite. You have to know one thing. He's in Persia, and he's not the king. He's only the Grand Vizier. Ahasuerus is the king, you see. So if that's the case, you can't just willy-nilly, what they call, kill everybody you want. You can't kill an entire people in any kingdom, you see. You have to be a certain type of person to do that. And besides, you're not in charge. It's Ahasuerus that's in charge. And remember, they pay tax, right? Jews pay tax. If you kill all the Jews, that's the end of the tax that you could collect. And in the olden days, that meant everything, tribute. Why do you think anybody wanted to conquer everybody else? It wasn't just to conquer, they wanted the tribute. They wanted the money. You see, I can't just kill them. And now that they're loyal citizens, they work, they're part of the Persian empires. You can't just kill them. But so then, why do you want to kill them? Just because you're angry at Mordechai? Why do you want to kill them? Second problem. Third problem, which is interesting. Haman goes over to Mordechai, and he says to him, you know, excuse me, I'm getting names confused. Haman goes over to Ahasuerus, and he says, and because he's got to convince Ahasuerus, so he says to him, Yeshli Am Afurad, there's a nation that's separate, and their religions are different, you know, and therefore what should we do, right? We should kill them. Now you can ask him, you know, does this justify the murder of all these, because he didn't say they did crimes, that's their way of life. Does this justify murder? That's the first thing. But what's bizarre about that accusation is this. It says in the Megillah, right, that he had 127 Medinas. He was the king over 127 provinces, which is enormous. And it says there also, each province had their language, Ketsom Lushoinam. Everybody had their own language. And what I told my, right, even though there was Persia, but Persia was the conqueror of many, many different cultures and languages, you see, and also religions, you see. So what's he talking about? What do you mean they're separate, they have a different religion? So there's the other 126. What is he talking about, this guy, you know? What kind of a time is that? And Ahasuerus says, fine, you know what I'm saying? Which itself doesn't make any sense. But what was the taina of Haman? Especially when he has, it says in the Gemara, Kiksovim Ula Kishoinam. He sent scripts out to all languages and cultures and so on, you know? So obviously, there are many countries just like Jews. So what was the argument then? This is the question. Not only that, it's always repeated again and again about Haman. You see? It gives the lineage. Ish, Ben Hamdasa, here's a whole yichus there, you know? But if it did it, so it does it once, fine. But it repeatedly does that throughout the Megillah. Why does it do that? We already know who this guy is. He's an Agogi, from Agog and so on. And he's Ben Hamdasa. And so, you know, why do we have to repeat this over and over again? You see, this is the difficulty in understanding the story of Haman. But if you think the story of Haman is difficult, you know, what about Amalek? Amalek makes no sense. And we know Haman is Amaleki. Obviously, he's Amalekite, right? Let's take a look at Amalek. And again, the story, if it wasn't for the fact that the Torah wrote it, I would never believe it happened. It's one of those kind of stories. You know, it doesn't make any sense. Why? Let's take a look. People make a mistake. They say, well, the Jews get out of Egypt, and they wiped out Egypt, obviously, right? And the Amalek heard about it, and they wanted to kill the Jews. What? Why? William, what's your problem, Amalek? Okay. Now, there are people who think that the Amalekis were atheists. That's wrong. There was no such thing as atheism in those days. Everybody believed in a religion. They didn't believe in one God, but they had a polytheism, right? They had many gods they believed in, right? So what's your problem? The Jews believe in that God, and you believe in your gods. So what do you want from these guys? What's the point of it? You also believe in a God. You see, they're not atheistic. Atheism is a product of Darwinism. You see, once they came up with an idea called evolution, then they can remove God from the whole scene. Before that, Nebuch people had a real problem. They couldn't remove God. Because how do you explain what's called the complexity and the diversity of species, or even the origin of species, you see? So Amalek was religious. They had their pantheon of gods, whatever, and so on, you know? So then why do you want to kill the Jews? Mystery. Doesn't make sense. That's the first problem. Second problem, why do people attack other people? Because they feel, usually feel threatened by them. So therefore, what they do is because there's a military threat, so they arm themselves, or they take, what's called, they preempt, and they kill the other people. The Medrash says that they had to cross five borders, Amalek, to get to the Jews. Five borders? That means they're not a threat to you. So then why do you want to kill them? That doesn't make sense at all. You see? Third problem. Do you know how much money it costs a man to war? When America went to war in Afghanistan, which is far away, it cost them $1 billion a day. Do you know how much money that is? $1 billion every day. Imagine, Amalek wants to mount a war against the Jews, right? So they gotta cross five boundaries, right? Not only that, it's not like there's stores in the wilderness to buy food from. There's nothing there. It's a wilderness, which means they have to take along the supplies. Do you know how long the supply train has to be to take an army that's sufficient to attack the Jews? You see, it's a fortune. For what? Doesn't make sense. What's the military campaign about? You see, they believe in a God. They know military threat. So why do it? Then there's another problem. You see, the Jews just got finished wiped, and they wiped out Egypt, right? Egypt is the greatest nation on earth at that time, on the Ramses, right? That means Amalek knew it was a suicide trip. They knew they were going to get killed. How do you fight a nation that just wiped out the greatest nation on earth? You can't. So it's a suicide trip. So why are they doing this? You see, none of this makes sense. That's also the question. I think each one boggles the mind. Remember, would you spend $1 million a day or whatever fortune when there's no reason at all to do it? And when you know you're going to get killed anyway? Right. Like so what's in their mind? And not only that, when the Jews left Egypt, it says there were 600,000 males, right? Above the age of 20. So if you count the below, right, and the women and the children, you're looking over 2.5 million people left Egypt. Do you have an idea what kind of army you have to mount to kill 2.5 million people? Well, what does that mean? You're going to tell me Amalek had they had an army of 2.5 million people? Nobody. How many? The only one who has like a standing army of 2.5 million people is who? Is North Korea. But that's because almost everybody's in the army in North Korea. That's how paranoid they are. You know what I'm saying? But that's what you need to do. So how could they have such an army? You see. And the last question I want to ask about Amalek is what? Why does God hate them so much? It says, "Mechama midor dor," that I will kill them. You have to kill Mitsui the killer Amaleki. Imagine what that is. That means if you see an Amaleki in the street, you have to say, "Excuse me, please wait for a minute." And the guy says, "Okay." Is that man? You pull out your gun and you blow him up. You kill him. That's it. That's a mitzvah. You see, why does the Hashem hate them? There are many people. Look what the Egyptians did. Yet the Hashem doesn't say that to Egypt. He says, right? You should not hate the mitzvah or whatever. That's the great mystery. How do we understand Amalek? It also makes no sense. Just like Haman did in the Megillah also makes no sense. You see. So what have I done? I have subjected the Megillah and Amalek and so on to what's called the test of reasonableness. This isn't reasonable. It's true. Of course, it's true. There's no doubt about that. Because the Torah says it's true, right? I have doubt about that. But like, how is this possible? We're not dealing with one guy by Amalek. We're dealing with the whole nation. You see, that's the question. Man is a very interesting creature. What does that mean? We all walk around with delusions of omnipotence. I don't know if you realize that. We all want to be somebody. You know, you have no idea how pervasive that is. Very pervasive. We want to be somebody. We don't want to be nobodies. Not only that, you see, but man, whether be conscious or even unconscious, you see, is always striving to do one of three things. Either he wants to become God, or he thinks he's God, or he wants to overthrow God. You see, man is in many ways obsessed with the Ribbono Shel Olam. Why? Because the Ribbono Shel Olam is omnipotent. He's all powerful, you see. And everybody wants to be all powerful, for whatever reason. I mean, psychologically, you can understand, because he somehow wants to overcome his feelings of inferiority or vulnerability or whatever it is. Because we all know that we are helpless. We are vulnerable to all kinds of problems and so on. So obviously, one of the best cures for that is to be omnipotent. Being God is one of the best solutions of all, right? Because Baruch Hashem has no limit. He has no dependencies, you see? And he has no insecurities or anything like that. Because the Russian can do whatever he wants and so on. So people are preoccupied, even if we don't realize that. Most 99% of our actions, believe it or not, is to feel like somebody. You can't believe how pervasive that need is and so on. But I'm not going to go into that. That's more psychological and so on. Now, where do you see this? Think about that. Adam Rishon, right? Go back to the first man. What did Adam Rishon want to do, right? He wanted to be God, right? When Chava ate from the tree, right? Before she ate from the tree, what did the Nachash say, the snake, who was the mouthpiece of the serpent? He said, Yisim kill the kim, you'll be like God. What? You mean it's a way of being like God? Yeah, eat from the tree. That was the argument. And Rashi says that what the Nachash said, the snake said, right, is that that's how God became God, you know? He ate from the tree, which of course was an incredible sheker. But that was the temptation. So he tempted Chava by saying, hey, you can become just like God. You see? All you have to do is eat from the tree. God says don't eat from the tree. Yeah, because he doesn't want any rivals. That's why, you see? It's amazing what the Nachash said. What Chava should have said to the Nachash, really, what would have been a great answer is, excuse me, If you're saying eating from the tree will make you like God, I have a defect here because he commanded me not. What about you? Why don't you eat from the tree? You know, she never did that. Where were you? You're offering me the whole kingdom. Why, right? You could also have the kingdom. How come you don't have it? You know, I'm sorry. Okay, she didn't do that. And of course, history changed because of that. But that was a temptation. You would be like God, right? And then, of course, she went over to Adam and repeated the argument. Even though by that time, right, she knew that the whole thing was sheker, was false, because she wasn't like God. As soon as she bit into that, she knew the whole thing was over. It was a fraud. It was a sham. Whatever. Anyway, Adam bought into that argument. Same thing, because they both had a desire to be God. You move ahead along in the Chumash, and then we have the Migdal Babel. What are they trying to do in the Tower of Babel? Overthrow God, right? That was their preoccupation, right? And yet it's amazing. A whole society, right? They're all united, and they have nothing better to do than overthrow God. I mean, incredible thing they thought they could do it. In other words, if they believed in God, then how did they think they can overthrow him? You see, because God obviously is in heaven. How did he get up there? You see, he must be much smarter than we are. So, like, what was their thinking? Could you imagine? And all of them are up there in the tower. However it was, you know what I mean? 1,000 feet high, right? In the World Trade Center, right? And they're all up there trying to kill God. I mean, they are the, I'll tell you one thing, if there was a psychiatrist who lived among them, right, he would never have a dearth of patients. He would have the whole society to treat. They're crazy people. But what was their matara? Their matara was to do what? Was to war with God. You see, overthrow him. Right? Okay, it's the second preoccupation. Then the third preoccupation, right, is Paro. Moshe Rabbeinu says, you know, God says, take my people out. So Paro said, who is God? What do you mean, who is God? You know, I am God. Because every Pharaoh believed he was God. You see, why is that? Man is always preoccupied. Why? Because the concept of a person always wants to overcome his sense of inferiority, his sense of vulnerability. Because he realizes he's vulnerable. In fact, infants have what's called a delusions of omnipotence. Yeah, until they learn, obviously, that they're not omnipotent, and they need their mother and their father and so on, you see? Because the greatest threat to man is that he realizes he is not omnipotent, and therefore he has to struggle with real life to survive. I don't get into the whole psychological barrier, but it's critical. And that's why everybody's involved. Maybe not directly being God and all that, because they already removed that possibility, you see? But everybody's involved in some way asserting conforming self, to confirm self. Anyway, but the ultimate idea of that is to war, to believe in God and so on, you see? Now, this is the problem. However, man is stuck. What does he mean stuck? Because he believes in God, you know? In the old days, they believed in God, you see? So, since the nature of man is to war with God, see, then he's stuck. He has no exit. He believes in God, which means he has to submit to God. Once you believe in God, once you believe he's omnipotent and so on, then you're stuck. You must submit to God. But it's very hard. Why do you think people find it so hard to listen to authority? Because we don't want to listen to anybody. Because that proves to us, really, that what? That we are inferior. That's what it's all about. But so therefore man is stuck. So what did mankind do? Mankind is brilliant. They invented 10 different strategies. It's called to have your cake and eat it too. That I can actually believe in God and do whatever I want. And the amazing thing is that each of these strategies ultimately is a religion. And you begin to understand what religion did. Every religion except Judaism has provided an exit. What does that mean? Where they can believe in God and still do whatever they want. Let's take a look. Now, I will give you 10 strategies. It's fascinating to realize what a religion really is, because they always have to leave some type of what's called some type of a loophole, so they don't have to listen to God, even though they believe in Him, and they worship Him to a certain extent. Let's take a look. Okay, the first greatest strategy is called atheism. You know, a guy says, hey, I don't believe in God altogether, right? So what he just did is he just knocked God off the map, and then he can do whatever he wants, right? Of course it's nonsense, because the greatest proof, bar none, of the existence of God is the complexity of the universe, the complexity of the human life, of 100 million life forms, that's how many there are. The complexity is impossible for chance that brought that about. It's the greatest proof of all. And anyway, there's just no refutation to that. So therefore, but an atheist somehow has convinced himself there is no God. Okay, that's bizarre. So the second strategy is agnosticism, where a guy says, listen, I don't know if there is or not, right? But I don't know, I'm a stupid. So until somebody comes and proves it to me, I'm going to do whatever I want. See? So that's an incredible strategy. So now he can do what he wants, you see. The third strategy is Aristotle, where Aristotle says, of course, God created the universe. Although his concept of create means they exist simultaneously and so on, you know. But God has nothing to do with the universe. Nothing. He couldn't care less what you do. That's beautiful, because I can believe in God and do what I want. You see? That's an incredible strategy, right? Each one allows me to do whatever I want. Okay? So that means God has nothing to do with the universe. That's number three. Number four, right? Okay, there is a God, yes, and he's powerful, but he's limited. He's limited. God is not omnipotent. Bilam. Remember the Rosh Hashanah said to Bilam, who are those guys outside the tent? Right? So Bilam said to himself, that's very interesting. Then God is not omniscient. He doesn't know everything. Oh. So if he doesn't know everything, then I can do whatever I want. He won't know anyway, because he's not omniscient, you see? That's how much of Bilam thought, you see? So that's number four, that God is not omniscient, one, or he's not omnipotent. And there's tremendous apikorsis. A guy wrote a book, you know, Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People? It was terrible apikorsis, you know, and his major thesis was that God is limited. The reason why bad things happen to good people is because never God can help himself. You see, he's limited. He can't stop it, you see. And that's how he was able to live with himself, whatever the tragedy that he had and so on, you know. But that's a fourth strategy, that he's limited, you see. And therefore, if he's limited, then I can do whatever I want. Fifth strategy, okay, he's not limited. But you know, there are two gods. At Zoroastrian, right? There's a god of good and the god of evil. And guess who's going to be my Rebbe? The god of evil. You see? Because he's going to protect me against the god of good. This is a whole religion. This is called Zoroastrianism. Think about that. We're not talking here about some little local belief. This is a religion, a major religion of Persia a long time ago. You see? That's the concept of there are two gods. You see? And therefore, the two gods, hey, my Rebbe is going to be the god of evil, not the god of good. You see? Wow. It's protected. Right? So that is number 4, 5. Number 6, right, is polytheism. Polytheism is you believe in many gods. You see? Why is that convenient for man? Because, like Greece, Greece had like a pantheon of 50 different deities. You know, whatever, Zeus and all these guys and so on, right? And all of them were quibbling with each other. They were fighting with each other. You see, so therefore, a guy says, you know, you ever hear the, you know, whoever does the Kule Beshamai and the Kule Beshilel, right? You know, so he picks and chooses the things that he would like to do from all the gods. So how can you go wrong? Because in every case, he's always got some god on his side. You see? So that's polytheism in many ways. It benefits a person by being able to do whatever he does, because whatever he wants to do, there's always some god out there that wants him to do it or couldn't care less. That's polytheism. You see? And that is number 6. Okay. Number 7. Showing you the incredible strategies where you can have an exit, you see. Strategy number 7 is what? Okay. Where man has the Rabbanu Shalom, God himself, doing the evil that he wants to do. Wow. And that took the Greeks did that. They had their gods doing what? Stealing and lying and raping. It was incredible. Their gods were doing this. So what do they have to be? You know what it says, Lidamus Bedrochov? You have to imitate God? Right? They said, okay, fine, I'll imitate God. There are so many religions that believe that God hates, and therefore they're mitzvah to kill, because they really want to kill. Except they made God do it, so therefore they can do it themselves. On the contrary, that's tzaddikim. You see? I mean, look at the twisted logic, but that's what they do. And the Greeks did it, you know, they had their, you know, and there are many gods. I hate to say it, but Islam is part of that, right? Where they believe that their God, whatever, it's, and it's Allah, whatever they call it, and so on. You know, but you gotta kill the Jews. You know, you gotta kill. What do you mean? God says you have to kill the Jews. What do you want from me? You see? So therefore, they can do all kinds of evil in the name of their God. So that's number 7. Strategy number 8 is, okay, no, that's not God, but you know what God did? The avoider is evil. You ever see Baal Peor? I mean, Baal Peor had a very unusual, you know, without getting too graphic, you know, they would relieve themselves in front of their God. I mean, what kind of an avoider is that, you know? I mean, you can try to ask, so what kind of a, you know, but when you have the avoider, in Roman times, a great deal of the service was zimo, was nus, you know what I'm saying? All kinds of sexuality. Why? Because what they did is they made that the avoider. So then what do you want from me? Adraba. If I do the ad avoider, it's a mitzvah. You see, it's a brilliant strategy, and it's done so many different times where you make the avoider itself vicious or evil. You see, so that's strategy number
8.
Is that 8?
Yeah.
Okay. Strategy number 9. God changed his mind. In the beginning, he said, "This is the way you do it," but it's too hard. You know, so I have charata. I'm going to change my mind. You now have to do something else. That's Christianity, where God saw that the Torah was too difficult. Who could do Tariyat mitzvahs, right? So therefore, he changed the whole thing to one mitzvah. Believe he died for the sins. That's it. And that's what Christianity is. They abrogated the entire Torah, you see? So basically, a Christian just has to believe, right, that he died for the sins, and you're okay, basically. That's a whole religion. There's 2 billion Christians who believe that. You see? So that's the 9th strategy. Where they act where God changes mind. It's called replacement theology in their terms, you know, where God replaced the Torah with their Torah, right? The Torah with their New Testament. He replaced the Nevuah and so on, you know, and he replaced the Jews. Some of the Jews, Christians, so on. And then there's a 10th strategy. What's the 10th strategy? 10th strategy is, I always It's the most brilliant of all, right? Where normally you want to do tshuva, right? You got to do tshuva, say, what do you got? You got to do chatasi, ovisi, pashati, and you got to mean it. You know what I'm saying? You have to mean it. No. But what happens if I give the power of tshuva in the hands of a priest? Oh, wow. This is gewaldig. So you go in and say, a guy says, listen, I stole a horse. So the priest says, okay, $50 to the pishka, to the tzedakah box, right? And I atone for your sin. It's gewaldig. It means you can buy off people because everybody has a self-interest. See, and in the Middle Ages, this was called indulgences. You know, it was haywire. The Catholic Church was worth a fortune because everybody said, what do I have to do tshuva for? I just give the guy tshuva. Of course, the guy said, of course, he won't do it again. Yeah, sure, right? But the thing is that the man himself had the power to atone. That's the critical concept, you see. And if the priest said, atone, you atone, and that's it, you see. And the Catholic Church was making a fortune on that. And that's brilliant. Where man can forgive, you don't need God to forgive. See, in Judaism, God, you know, it's the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's what Yom Kippur is all about, right? You can't bribe God, but man can always be bribed. Anyway, you got 10 incredible strategies. What were the strategies for? How to exit. That even though I believe in God, right, it's still possible for me to do whatever I want. Because the clash is always between the self and God. We're always, the self is always at war with God. Whether we realize it or not, the concept of merido, to be merged by Malchus. You see, that's why do you think we say Kriya Shema all the time? Kabbalas ol Malchus Shemayim. Because the tendency of man is always to be merged, not to be makabal, you see. Now that we understand, we begin to understand this. Avraham Avinu, right? Avraham Avinu, you know, he destroyed idols, he was preaching one God. Why do you want to kill him? You know, why don't you just lock him up or whatever? But Avraham Avinu was a very dangerous person. Why? Because he defied something. What did he do? Because every religion, like I said, right? What they do is they believe in many gods, right? And they believe, you know, it's not that they believe in God, but they believe in many gods. Avraham Avinu came along and said something radical. He says, wait a minute. First of all, there's only one God. There are no other gods. So forget about running to them. You see? The second thing is that this God is righteous, he's moral, he's just, and you are accountable. Nobody can hear that. Why? Because it didn't provide mankind with an exit. This is the problem. So Avraham Avinu, it wasn't just that he was preaching there's another religion called monotheism. That's one thing. But what he was doing, he was taking away the ability of mankind to have an exit, you see? Because if there's one God, and not only that, you can't bribe him, right? You're accountable. He's omnipotent and omniscient and so on. And you're accountable, as I've said, right? And he's righteous. He's just. He's moral. Then it's terrible. What are we going to do? You see? Therefore, Avraham Avinu had to die. Avraham Avinu was a tremendous threat to the concept of religion at his time. You see? Who inherited what Nimrod wanted to do? Amalek. Now you begin to understand Amalek, and it answers all the questions, you see. What Amalek did was unusual. Of course Amalek had their own pantheon of gods. They were polytheistic. They were everybody was under Brother Zara. But they realized that there was something about Jews that was incredibly threatening to the human race. What was that? Because what the Jews said, there's only one God, number one, and he is just, moral, righteous, you see, and that you are accountable. What they did, what the Jews, they realized is they left no exit. That's the problem. And therefore, they were willing to kill the Jews, even though they knew it was a suicide mission. You see, that's really what they were about. Because it makes no sense. Like I said, you know, why would, they were polytheistic, but the Jews were not only monotheistic, one God, but their kind of God was nothing like they've ever encountered, and it was an unbelievable threat to mankind. Just like Avraham Avinu, same idea, you see. Not only that, the threat of Jews wasn't military, it was ideological, it was theological, and they could not tolerate that, as you will see, who was the person who arose, who mamish did the same thing. In any case, okay. Not only that, it's a fortune. It was worth a fortune to fight the Jews not to have that shita. And that's really what their shita was, and so on. And therefore, the incredible thing about Amalek is they were willing to commit suicide. That type of understanding of God, religion, must be stamped out, you see. And therefore, even though it meant the death of them, which it did in the end, and it was only Yeshua was killing them, and the Bereshit, it was a divine decree, don't kill them. That's what the Bereshit said. Because as long as that philosophy can exist in other places, then you can't just kill them out, and so on. In any case, but they were willing to commit suicide. And that's why the Bereshit hates them. Why? Because it's not only that they were willing to die, wanted to kill the Jews because of that theological view, you see. They were willing to kill themselves, suicide. That's the greatest mockery of all, you should know. Why? It's one thing if you don't believe in God. Okay, you'll wake up someday because you're going to take a look at the complexity of the universe and it's beyond belief, you know. But to believe in God and to mock him, you see, by, okay, we believe in you and then we do what we want anyway, that's the greatest, that's the greatest chorban of all. Very dangerous. In fact, you see that from the word Amalek, the Rosh HaTevis of the word Amalek is Ol Malchus Lo Kiblu. The kingdom of heaven, Lo Kiblu, that's Amalek, right? They didn't accept. It doesn't say that they didn't believe in God, they did. But they made a mockery of accepting the commandments of God. They did not accept Ol Malchus. Instead, they did what? They compromised the entire concept of Ol Malchus. And that is really the terrible, terrible threat of what Amalek is. Haman is an Amaleki. He knew what originally, he comes from the same tribe that wanted to kill the Jews. But he figured, hey, you know, the Jews, but they don't believe in this stuff anymore. All of a sudden, along comes a guy, Mordechai, right? Now, Mordechai, he's walking. Mordechai should have bowed. Why? Because a person should be interested in himself, his self-interest. So therefore, it would have made sense for Mordechai to bow, to try to curry favor with Haman. Makes sense. But Mordechai didn't bow. That means Mordechai believed that he serves a God, that he has to put away his self-interest, because God is righteous and just. You can't exit and do whatever you want. You need to serve God. So that's why I said, who's this guy? And the guy said, a Yehudi. So Haman said, wait a minute, you mean the guys that my ancestors try to kill, they still believe in this stuff? Where God will supersede any of their own desires? And even though Mordechai should have bowed to me, because it would have made sense, then I would have liked him and I'd do him favors. But he didn't, because he can't go against God. You can't exit God. You have to worship the real God. You see, you can't compromise with God. So when Haman realized, wait a minute, they're still doing this stuff? Wait a minute, that's what my ancestors killed them for. So that's when he said, I not only have to kill Mordechai, I got to follow my ancestral traditions. Right? I got to pick up the Yerusha. I got to kill them all. You see, therefore, that's why Haman wanted to kill everybody, because he realized the Jews still hold what they originally hold 1,000 years before. I got to pick up the slack. My forerunners failed. I need to do it. I got to pick up the slack. I got to kill them all. See? So what he simply did is he followed the tremendous mission to destroy the Jews. And that's why he wanted to kill them all, you see. And that's why the Megillah keeps saying the Yichus, Haman ben Agar, Dasa, and so on. Why? Because it's telling you, it's not Haman doing it for himself. It's Haman following the traditions of Amalek. That's why he keeps bringing his Yichus. You see? We just have to hear it once, that's it. But since he's doing this for his people, he's following the Shita of his people, the opinion of his people, it keeps telling us it's not him only. He's following, this is a classic Amaleki that wants to kill the Jews for the same reason. And now we understand beautifully. It goes over to who? It goes to Achashverosh. And he says, wait a minute, there's a nation that's different than all of us. It's separate and so on. So Achashverosh could have said to him, what's your problem? I got 127 countries. They're all different. No, but Haman said, no, you don't understand. None of them have, Every one of them has an exit. Jews don't have an exit. They believe in a God who's righteous, just, virtuous, and so on. And we're accountable to him. We can't bribe him. Forget it. There's no exit. We must do what he says. There's no way we could do whatever we want to do and still believe in him. That's the greatest threat to the world, you see. And then Ahasuerus said, fine. That type of religion, you're right. That's got to be stamped out and so on. And of course, he didn't want to do it simply, because after all, they do give tax. So Ahasuerus, Haman handed him a fortune. 10,000 talents of silver, they estimated today's value to be over $100 million. He was fabulously wealthy, you see. And of course, $100 million, even then, goes a long way, you see. Once he wasn't worried about the money, so then, okay, then let's kill him. Because even that doesn't make sense. Why would a king kill Jews for nothing, you see? And that's the concept of what Haman convinced them, you see. Now, if you think all of this, wow, it's incredible. I mean, Haman, the story of Haman is what? When did that happen, the story of Haman? It happened approximately 300 BCE. That's like 2,300 years ago. This didn't happen today, you see? The Shito of Amalek, this doesn't happen today, where the Jews are the most dangerous people alive. Excuse me. It happened 70 years ago. Hitler, Yimach Shemai. Do you know what that was really all about? What was it? Why did this man hate the Jews? I mean, his hatred for the Jews was beyond comprehension. It was absolute. Why? I'll tell you why, which is a very important idea. Hitler wrote a book called, in 1923, if I recall, Mein Kampf. In that book, he says why he hated the Jews and why he believed they have to be killed, literally, just like Amalek. You see, what was the reason? Because he said that the Jews have made us into wimps. They gave us a conscience. You see, the Germans felt, right, the Aryan race, the Superman, Nietzsche. You see, they had this incredible delusion about who they are. In fact, even their national anthem, Deutschland über alles, you know? And so, what do you mean, Deutschland über alles? Excuse me, what, are you crazy? Why do you have to be über alles? Why can't you be mit allemen, as they say, you know? With everybody, what's this über alles? Even their national anthem reflects megalomania, you see? So therefore, Hitler hated them. Why? Because he understood the theology and the message of Amalek. What was that? That there's no exit, you see? The Jews have made us, he says, in the Mein Kampf, they have made us into wimps. Wimps. They gave us a conscience. It means we cannot compromise with God, you see? And here they made everybody into wimps. He said the whole Christianity is a bunch of losers because of that. You see, whose sheet is this? Who does it sound like? It's Mama Shalomet, you see? So we realize, therefore, this is this phenomenon where people hate the Jews because the theology of the Jews, that's why they hate Jews, and that's why Hitler. And I want to tell you something. Did Hitler commit suicide? Yes. You know what they did? He writes this in the Rise and Fall of the Third Reich by William Shirer. It's a thick book. But he writes several incredible ideas. One of the ideas that he writes, which is really remarkable, he says at the end of the war, the German generals, came over to them and they said to them, you know, hey, we're losing the war. So Hitler said to them, what's the problem? Why? I mean, the German army was incredible. They really had an incredible army. I mean, really, it's only a nest that they didn't take over the entire world. A tremendous air force and the Luftwaffe and the army, the Wehrmacht, and so on. They had military down to a science. But what happened? So Hitler said, well, why are we losing? You know, so they said, because why? Because we need to ship troops to the front. So what's the problem? You're taking all the trains and bringing the Jews to the concentration camps. We don't have any railroad cars anymore. You believe this? That's what they told Hitler. You're busy shipping the Jews. We have no cars to bring the troops to the front. You see? So what are we fighting with? You know what Hitler told them? I mean, what they really told them is very simple. The war's over. We're dying. We're losing. Why? Because you're more interested in killing the Jews than you want victory of Germany. That's really what they told them, right? And you know what Hitler told them? told them, get lost. But he said it in German. Whatever he said. What is that supposed to mean? What does that mean even? Hitler held that the destruction of the Jews is a greater cause, right, than the victory of Germany over the world. And it's impossible to believe. Why? Because remember the Third Reich will be last for 1,000 years. Wouldn't last 1,000, not even gonna last more than three, four years. It's over with. Which is remarkable. That's suicide, isn't it? Doesn't that sound like a Moloch to you? He would rather lose the war, right? Than he'd rather lose and have the Jews killed, right? Than have victory for Germany. Which doesn't make sense. Because if you have victory for Germany, they can certainly kill the rest of the Jews. But whatever it was insane. What does that show you? That's he's willing to sacrifice Germany to kill the Jews. That's mamish exactly what a monarch is. In fact, Hitler was probably, if you know the code for the Germans, there's a whole code between the Megillah, it was there a long time ago. I don't know if you remember that code, it's incredible. But from that, there's a code in the Megillah that clearly indicates that Hitler was Haman, his 10 ministers were the 10 sons of Haman. Clearly indicates that.
And one of them was the daughter.
Yeah, and Goebbels, if I remember correctly, one of the people who died, of course, was his daughter, the daughter of Haman, because she threw herself over the roof because she saw a man leading Mordechai. So she didn't see it, but she saw a man leading another man on the king's horse and all that kind of stuff. So she thought that the man leading, whoever was on top, would be Mordechai. So she took the garbage, which in those days was real garbage, you know. And she just threw it over and it landed on her father. And when she realized it was her father, I mean, imagine Haman leading, you know, not only is he mavuyish, terrible degradation, but a grand vizier to be leading some Jew, right? And now she throws the garbage, so it says she was so distraught, she threw herself over the balcony and killed herself, you see. So the interesting thing is that there were 10 ministers, actually there were 11, but one of them, I think it was Goebbels, he committed suicide because he took a piece of cyanide, which they all carried, and he swallowed and killed himself. Goebbels never really stood trial. And Goebbels was a cross-dresser, transvestite, that's who he was. And so that's a giggle of the daughter. But in any case, this is a whole cult of the, I could tell it if you want to know.
I think the Belzarebi was the one who...
whatever, but it's clear. Germany is Amalek, Hitler was Haman, the 10 ministers are his sons, and Goebbels, of course, is the daughter. And the famous line, of course, is Julius Streicher, when they were hanging him, right before they hung him, you know, he was one of the people of the Hitler's regime, he said Purimfest, which was recorded in Time magazine. And nobody knows what he meant, but he obviously saw the incredible analogy here. Where not only Hitler's dead, all 10 ministers, which are the 10 sons, and they're all being killed, you know. But he actually said the word Purimfest. Anyway, without getting into the code and so on and so forth, this, we see a reenactment of the whole concept of Amalek. It's a very important idea. This is, in many ways, once you understand this concept, this tells us something very important. Why is there anti-Semitism in the world? You know, yeah, people think, you know, I mean, the most common reason people say is because they're jealous of the Jews. Okay, they say it, right? They say the Jews are this, the Jews can control that, the protocols of the elders of Zion, all this falsehood and so on, you know. But that's not the real reason why there's anti-Semitism. The real reason why there's anti-Semitism, Chazal say, because they ask, why do they call Har Sinai, Sinai? Why do they call Mount Sinai, Sinai? So the Chazal say, because from there, sinah went to the world. Hatred of the Jews went to the world. That's what the Chazal say. The question is, what does that mean? What do you mean? Because we got the Torah Mount Har Sinai, therefore that produced, generated sinah? The answer is yes. What we see is, yes, they don't hate Jews, they hate God. They hate the God that the Jews promoted. That it's one God, He is righteous, just, virtuous, moral. Not only that, he's omniscient, omnipresent, and so on, omnipotent. Not only that, you are accountable to him. You see, that's what they hate. Mankind hates the Jews because we are the ambassadors of God that represent that particular theology. And that is the exact theology that Amalek said and hit the Yimach Shamayim. That's why there's real anti-Semitism. Mankind has never forgiven the Jews for receiving the Torah and for promoting the belief of this type of God. It's a very, very profound concept of the real origin, because it's against the nature of man. Remember, man always struggles. Self versus God. Who's the boss? Who will win? And this has been going on throughout history, you see. And in the end, we learn something very important, that what Judaism fundamentally believes is you cannot compromise God. You ever notice in the Torah, it always says, Kasha Tzivo Hashem es Moshe? You ever notice that? Why does it say so many times, Kasha Tzivo, as God commanded Moses? You know, how can you say it once, say it twice? Oh, we get it. You know what I'm saying? We really get it. You know, that he obviously does what God wants. No, you have to understand, Moshe never took an exit, you see. Whatever God told him, he did exactly. Whereas every other religion, they bend the rules. You see, that's what the Torah is always telling us. See, Hashem is Moshe, you cannot compromise God. You need to do exactly what the Rebbeinu wants. And that's the greatest shvach to Moshe Rabbeinu, you see. Very important idea, you see. We now understand a lot of the ideas. I showed you the whole concept that the whole story of Purim should never have happened, because it's one miracle after the other. I showed you 15 miracles that could never have happened, yet all happened. And I told you why. Because history is nothing more than the acts of God. And we are the players. But guess what? The script is the Ribbono Shel Olam. Minimal, you see. And I showed you that. A very important idea. A second idea, why Haman did what he did. Because what he thought he was doing was a mitzvah, so to speak, to carry out the will of his ancestors, Amalek, to kill the Jews. That's basically what he did, you see. And it also shows you that that concept, that theology, that theological understanding, right, that you need an exit where you can compromise God, even though you still believe in him, right? Mankind has never forgiven the Jews. Just like they didn't forgive, Nimrod didn't forgive Avraham Avinu, all right? And Hitler, of course, never forgave the Jews. And in the end, it's interesting that Hitler was the greatest traitor of Germany. Think about that. The man could have had a victory, but he gave it up to kill the Jews. That is the betrayal of Germany. If you ask any country, what do you think about this guy? This guy's a traitor. How do you do something like that? Yet the hatred and the animus that he had called Kleinsfeld was a million times greater than the hatred he had for everybody else, and even his desire to conquer the entire world, which is beyond belief when you think about that, because his whole point was to have the Third Reich 1,000 years. But we learn from this one thing, that there is no exit. It's the Ribbono Shel Olam. And that's what we have to understand. There's no compromise with the Ribbono Shel Olam. He wants us to do his will, and that's the end of it. Of course, if you don't do his will, then the Ribbono Shel Olam is a mischase, there's a merachem on you. You know, there are many ways to return. It's clearly like that, you see. But in the end, you can't deviate. You can't play around with the Ribbono Shel Olam. Unfortunately, you find the reform movement, right? The conservative movement, what are they really doing? You know, who's serving who? Is man serving God? Or does God serve man? You see, that's basically what the reformed and conservative are. The reformed, and now you understand in a much greater context, the reform movement, the conservative, the reconstructionist, right? And the open orthodoxy, which is the newest brand of Mises, and so on, you know? All of them do one thing. They all are looking for an exit. Like Amalek in Judaism, you see? And they think they found it. And because each one wants to controvert the halacha, or the Torah itself. Because what do we see? Mankind is all, even Jews, they're always looking for an exit. An exit means a loophole where I can do it. I can have my cake and eat it too. I can do whatever I want and still believe in God. It's a terrible dilemma for man, you see? And that's really all these things are nothing than modern day versions of Amalek. Of course, they don't want to kill Jews. That's a different story, you know. But it's nothing more than people looking for exits, for loopholes, to be able to compromise God in every which way. So they have all kinds of excuses, you know, and so on, you know. That's really what we face. In other words, the concept of Amalek, the difference of Amalek, however, is they were willing to commit suicide. See, that's a new level. That's Mesiras Nefesh. That's a new level. That Amalek is Mesiras Nefesh. You see, that's why the Baruch Hashem says, I got to wipe these guys out. Because that kind of thing you can't tolerate. They're willing to die for this stuff. You see? So that's what we realize. Don't think Amalek is gone. What they did, the hatred that they have is the exact same thing. It's being done every day of the week in Eretz Israel, especially in America, all over the world. And that's what we have to take home, a main message of Purim. You need to do the will of God, which is the complete will. Of course, you make mistakes, fine. So that's why you have tshuva. You have vidui, charot, and kapara la'osen. You see, fine, okay. Nobody's going to say, nobody's perfect. But you can't want to deviate from the Ratzon HaBorei, you see. And you certainly cannot lead other people astray. That's a chaytin of machdis or rabin. A sinner, and he makes other Jews sin, you see. And that's what we have to be careful of. And that, in many ways, is an essential message of Purim. There are other messages, which we won't go into. But that's one of the most important, this concept. That Amalek, unfortunately, is alive, he's well, and he's kicking today. Thank you.
Okay. Amalek is not a specific group of people. It's everyone everywhere. It's a
yeah, I mean, today really there's no Amalek. They've been intermarried. I mean, there's no nation called Amalek, you know. But Amalek has been elevated to a theology, to a shita, see? And that's why Germany, and that's why, because that was the whole World War II, kill the Jews. See, in fact, Hitler was not interested, really. Take over Europe and kill all the Jews, because the Jews was his primary enemy. That was his focus.
How about Iran? People say Iran now is that, like, that I'm like shifted to Iran. Like, how well do they fit into that mold?
Iran would be Yishmael. Would be the Arabs. Well, the Arabs are really Yishmael. But Iran would be the evil of Yishmael. By the way, Yishmael is from Chuvah. I mean, I can get into that, but if anybody wants to hear any of my other stuff on current events, you can either do YouTube, Google TorahThinking.com, or TorahAnytime.org, I think, you know. But you could follow the current events. It's much too long. But the reason why this is so important, because we are living exactly what Amalek did. We have all kinds of enemies outside that are trying to compromise Judaism.
I heard them say the Arafat was Amalek.
What was that?
I heard they said the Arafat was Amalek, or people said.
No, he's Ishmael.
He's Ishmael.
No. Ishmael is an Arab. I mean, it's Islam. You know? Look, each one has its... Islam tries to... You know, Amalek wants to kill the Jews. The Islam wants to, what's called... overturn the Jews, they want to take over Judaism. In fact, they all want to take over. Christianity wants to take them over. They want to be the, why do you think, it's funny, you know, the concept of Odom. Odom means man, you know. And why is Odom, you are called man. Why? Because a person who's called an Odom really is able to do tikkun on the Bria. A certain type of neshama. That's why Adam is very, only a Jew is an Adam, because only he can move, he can make corrections, tremendous tikkunim in the heavens, in the upper worlds with his acts, you know. But these two religions, Islam and Christianity, they want to usurp Judaism. That's why they're trying to usurp the name also. That's why Yishmael is called Pera Adam. Problem, he's not an Adam, he's a para-Adam. He's a wild man. And even Esav, which is Christianity, is Edom, right? He also wants to be Adam. You see, everybody's trying to get the Adam. So only Jews are really Adam. Yishmael is para-Adam, and Esav is Edom. You see, they never, because their job is to usurp Judaism, take it over. It's called rivalry. you see. But Amalek wasn't interested in taking over Judaism. I want to kill everybody. That's the difference. Everybody's got a different program. You see, you know. Anything else?
Would you say that Trump is fulfilling his role?
Every day that goes by, it's beyond belief what the man is doing. Just incredible. Now with the rise of the scandals with the Democrats, you know, and the fact that everybody knows the Russian dossier is really a fraud, everybody knows that now. And the fact that the Democrats, the top echelons of government, it's corrupt, that's a threat to democracy. I hope they understand that. What these guys did, the Department of Justice, the FBI, and the NSA, all of them threatened democracy. Because what they've done is what every dictatorship does. They politicized and weaponized the government against people that disagree with them. That's not a democracy anymore. It becomes a dictatorship. It's a tremendous threat to democracy. That's really what's happened. So that's a tremendous blow against the Democrats, you see? And besides the Russian dossier. And then anyway, they're going after what's called the Uranium One scandal. And Hillary, I mean, she's incredible. You know, they're going after her. But, and look at what Trump has done. I mean, you have any idea what Trump has done in the last 3 months? Beyond belief, you know? He goes to the coastal. I'll just give you a little, you know, a while back he went to the coastal, puts a crystal in the wall, right? That's an admission that what? That the God of Israel is supreme. Then he gives a Hanukkah party, right? Where he basically admits that the Beis HaMikdash is ours, right? And then he declares Jerusalem to be the capital, which means the holy city of Jerusalem is yours. Right? If Jerusalem is ours, then Israel must be ours too, because you don't have a capital if you don't have a state, right? So obviously the state of Israel is ours, right? And then he releases Rubashtim, which basically says everybody that we were wrong. You know, we put you in jail for nothing. Yeah, that's why he commuted him, because it was the wrong thing to have Rubashtim in. And that's a Hidor that they've been doing this for 2,000 years to Jews, you see? And then Pence gives a speech, which is beyond belief, if you look at his speech. For America to say what he did, where he legitimatized everything. The Jews own it, the founding fathers of America used the Torah, and the Hamaria was a Kedah. I mean, you know, I thought it was a rabbi talking, not Pence. you know? And you see, I had explained, but even now, what do you think happened now? With the bombing of Iran, of Syria, right? They bombed, they sent a drone in, right? Syria sent a drone, and Israel responded, right? It was also incredible, and I don't know if anybody realized what's going on with them. So Israel responded, but they took out half the Syrian Air Force, or the missile, the sites, incredible, 12 sites. They did more damage now. Last time they did that was since 1982. But that's incredible. Why? Because first of all, it shows that the Iranians, the Russians, and the Syrians were shocked, because they didn't realize that Israel knows all the places, because a lot of these places were supposed to be concealed. How did Israel know about that? So they now realize that Israel has intelligence, which is incredible. Nobody believed this. Because, like I said, they bombed places that they thought were hidden. And that means they now realize, hey, they know all about us, you know? We're all naked now. So how are we gonna hide everything, you see? Number two, it's an incredible deterrence. See, now they really have a deterrence. Russia, certainly Syria, and Iran. Then number three, if Israel could do that in one day, could you imagine how great their military hardware must be? So now everybody's going to flock to buy their hardware, the military hardware, you know? Because that hardware overcame all the defense of Russian missiles and all that, you see? But number four is even better. You have to look at what this means, right? Because Saudi Arabia wants to join with Israel as a bulwark against Iran, you know? But until then, it was theoretical. But now they see, it's incredible. Israel is not afraid of anybody. They'll really do it. Israel can bomb all of them, you know? So Saudi Arabia, this even encourages more that Saudi Arabia should ally itself with Israel. You see, because they actually did it, and they took out half the air force of Syria. So that's the truth of Ishmael, even greater. So with that one drone accelerated the repentance of Ishmael. You see? Because it made real what Israel could do. No more just theory. It made it real, you see? All this came because of one drone. What a miscalculation, you see? And wherever you go, you have just Israel is rising among the nations. You have to understand what, you have to see what's going on. Israel is no more a little backward banana republic, you know. Israel is rising to the top, you see, and that's one of the reasons why America has to become wealthy. Because if America becomes wealthy again, they become prestigious, then whoever they value will also become prestigious, which is Israel. And then everybody's going to flock to do trade with Israel because they all want to curry favor with America. You see, that's the way it works. Not only that, Israel is a world leader in what? In medicine, cyber security, and agriculture, water conservation, and military hardware. It's a world leader. It's incredible because Israel only has, what, 8.5 million people? I mean, it's nothing. Israel has less people, or I should say the entire, Israel has less than 0.25% of the world's population. Yet Israel is almost one of the greatest nations on earth. It's just beyond belief. Why do you think that's happening? Because we are approaching the Messianic era. Israel is going up. So you have Edom doing tshuva, Trump. Then you have Yishmael doing tshuva, which is unheard of. You know, India wanted, Air India wants to go to Israel. So the problem is Elal always has to fly around Saudi Arabia, right? They can't fly over Saudi Arabia because Saudi Arabia will never let, right? And now guess what? Air India is flying over Saudi Arabia to land in Ben Gurion. It's unheard of, you see? And the whole Saudi Arabia is changing. Mohammed bin Salman is doing tshuva. That's what he's doing. He's getting rid of the Wahhabis. There's a great deal of stuff, but it's astounding to watch what is happening. Al-Bashir is slowly taking out all the enemies and raising Israel in terms of the sophistication of the civilization and so on. The only thing he's not doing, he hasn't done yet, and that's the Iker, is the Ruchnius. He must bring back the Jews to the Torah. Because that's the main redemption. In Egypt, the whole point of getting out of Egypt wasn't just to get out of Egypt. It was to have Torah at Har Sinai. Without Har Sinai, then everything else becomes irrelevant. We don't realize that. And therefore, what the Bansham did is he took them out of Egypt in order to give them Har Sinai, Mount Torah. And that's the Geula. There's a physical redemption and there's a spiritual redemption. And the spiritual redemption must happen before the Mashiach comes. Is it happening? Hopefully. But there are things that also indicate something like that. Yeah?
In our days, where do you see the Arab Rab versus Amalek?
The Arab Rab versus Amalek?
Yeah. In one of your talks, you mentioned that we had eight enemies.
Yeah.
That has to be dealt with, the Arab Rab and Amalek.
Well, Amalek is at the end.
Yeah,
and he's on the end.
And Arab Rab?
Well, the Arab Rab is the reformed conservative leaders, and unfortunately, Israeli government. That's all the Arab Rab. You know, because Israel suffers terribly in Mukhnias, the problem with Shabbos, and with no Jewish education in the schools in Israel. It's terrible, you know. That's the Arab Rab, you know. But someday that will go. It's interesting to watch that the police have recommended indictment against is this the beginning of the end? Who knows?
You mentioned in your talk also that Hashem, as a divine decree, let Amalek continue through the Dorot. Is it you see
divine decree what?
Let Amalek live with Yeshua, the stories that go on with Shul.
Yeah.
Is there an understanding of why he lets them go to the end?
Amalek. Because that is the greatest of evil you can do. It's a mockery of God. It's the greatest evil you can do.
So why leave it to the end?
Because that cheetah will always exist. Mm-hmm. You see, you wipe them out. What have you really done? Okay, you killed Amalek, that's true, you know. But that concept. So what God wants is that Jews have to destroy. You see, that's the avoid, is for the Jews to destroy that theological position. And therefore, it has to still exist.
Thank you.
Okay.
There's a concept of there being a Chag HaGeula, which is
what?
A Chag HaGeula.
Who?
Chag HaGeula.
Chag HaGeula?
Right, Keneged Pesach. The Purim was Keneged Shavuot. Hanukkah was Keneged Sukkot. And there's going to be a final. And it's this concept that we're living right now, the times of a Megillah, you're talking about all these astounding events that are happening.
Yes.
And one day it's all going to be written down in this Megillah that's also going to be, none of it makes sense. But how Hashem brought around the Geula and how Hashem brought...
Let me tell you one more thing and I'm out of here. There are three sukkim in the Torah, which indicate messianic program. One is v'nahapichu, by the Megill, right? And it was overturned in one shot. Haman went from being the grand vizier at night to being hung 2 days later. That's v'nahapichu, which is incredible. That's messianic, that's redemptive. When overnight, it's like in a blink of an eye, it's overturned. The second thing, okay, is Eben Masu Habonim, the one that the builders despise, Hoyusel Rosh Pino, or the stone that the builders despise, Hoyusel Rosh Pino, became the cornerstone, you see, and that was Mordechai. The Haman despised the Melech Hashverosh, and overnight, he became the cornerstone, he became the grand vizier, you see? And so, you know, and you see that also by Trump, v'nahapichu, overnight he was elected, nobody thought he would. And Evan Marshall, everybody hated the guy, and he still became president, right? Because that's the classic messianic approach. But the third pasuk is the Hisyatzu Ru'u. Stand back and watch, like Kriyat Samsuf, as Yeshua Hashem, the salvation of God. You see, we don't do anything. Who took out all the Arab nations? It's astounding, think about that, right? Who took them out? There's not a, the IDF probably can't believe what's happening, you see? You talk about, remember Russia with Gorbachev and Yeltsin? Russia was overthrown in 3 days, if you remember, in 1990. It was overthrown without a bullet being fired. Would anybody have ever believed that? The Berlin Wall collapsed overnight, okay? And not only that, we see this constant, first it was, it all started in, was it Tunisia? I think it was Tunisia. It all started, you know, and all of a sudden, Libya is no more. Egypt is falling, it's on the ropes already, you know. And then you have Lebanon is finished, Syria is finished, you know, Afghanistan is finished, Iraq is finished. It's like, and what did Jews do? Nothing. They fell by themselves, you see. That's the concept of Hisyatzu, stand back and watch the salvation of God. That's exactly, well, the IDF does nothing. You know, maybe they're going to retirement, you know. But that's fundamentally what seems to be happening, and that always happens at the end of time, like Kriya Samsa, where God says, don't worry, you see that Egyptian army? What you see today, you will never see them again. Moshe Rabbeinu says that, you know? Why? Because this is the redemption. In the redemption, you don't have to do anything. It's all been done. God will wipe them out, and it's exactly what he does. And he has wiped out Ishmael. And not only that, he's wiping out the evil of America. That's what he's done. All of a sudden, he took a man, a businessman, Trump, and out of nowhere the guy became president, and Trump is changing America. He's doing incredible stuff. I mean, you know, with the foreign policy, with the tax, and so on and so forth. He's taking away all the regulations and the bureaucracy. If you heard his State of the Union speech or what he's done, it's incredible. He's changing America. It's about a half week overnight. I mean, you know, and nobody expected, he himself didn't expect himself to be elected president. This all smells like redemption. Because that's the way it works. In the end of time, God just works. He does it himself. You don't need Ishtavlus. The Ishtavlus has been the 4,000 years of Avraham Avinu, has been the Isurin and the Golos, 2,000 years of Golos. We've done what we can. You know, Judaism is always on the ropes. It's already on the ropes. It's fallen so bad. There's so many Jews that have gone and so on. And what the Baruch Hashem was saying, it's over with. I now will take over and bring the Geula. And then you see that. What's happening now is, whoever heard that a president should take away $285 million from the UN? And whoever heard that, you know? And that's what he did. Take money from the UN, take money away from the UNRWA, and he defined the UN. You know, this kind of stuff doesn't happen, but it's happening now. Here's the problem. The problem is that, if 15 miracles happen to you in one day, guess what? By the time the 16th miracle happens, you know what you say? Ho-hum. Why? You know, because you don't even see it anymore. It's like, of course, you know. The problem is we don't see. Each one of these things is a mess. The UN, Jerusalem should be the capital. The destruction of Syria, it's a basket case. And so on, the destruction, not only that, the fact that America is the greatest oil producer in the world now, and OPEC is having terrible times charging for oil, that's why so many countries are going bankrupt. The world has changed in the last 7 years. Mom has changed, you know? And it's not like we can explain why and how. It just happens. That's Hisyats Ru'u. And that character, that midah of the Rosham, when he does that, is messianic. That's what's happening. And you have to realize, the problem, like I say, it happens different places, different times, but it's all converging. So the problem is that we don't recognize that each one is a nest that had never happened before, you see? But when it's like the Purim story, you put it all together, and bingo, Mordechai is the main person. That's why we don't see anything. People don't realize what's happening, but it's just incredible to watch. Yeah?
Isn't the fighting supposed to get worse at the end?
What?
Isn't the fighting supposed to get worse?
Where?
At the end. The Jewish people converging on Israel and the Jews.
No. No, it's just opposition. That's all. It's just opposition. The terrible slaughter that the Jews should have received, which is predicted in Sanhedrin, was absorbed by the Holocaust. Now it's just going to be a lot of confrontations, uncomfortable, you know, and so on. You know, think about that. In the end, it's supposed to be all good. You know, there's supposed to be the whole world is against Israel, right? Over Jerusalem, which is in the It's happening. It only happened. The UN. The UN, the Gemati of Goy Gomogog is 70. The UN are the 70 nations. And guess what? What's their major opposition? Jerusalem. They're going crazy. That's exactly what Yechezkel said. You see, it doesn't have to happen into an army, but once the Holocaust absorbed all the slaughter that would have come to the Jews for whatever reason, then now it's just oppositions. And the UN is Goy Gomogog. It's really what it is. Okay. I'm a dog.
Yeah.